I hope that everyone within our constant listener base that practices the Jewish faith is enjoyed a thoughtful Passover this week. Speaking of constant listeners, you find yourself in episode 153 of the Far Middle Podcast, and you are listening to your host, Nick DeOlius, right smack in the middle of a fine spring. Now, last week, the theme in Storyboard, if you recall, for episode 152, was how little lies could lead to epic problems when those little lies drive poor policy. This week, for episode 153, let's do an about-face and spend our time discussing connections that tie to the theme of big truths, a nice bookend and alter ego to last week's little lies theme. And oh, by the way, if you're listening on the day that we first air this episode, it's part of my Far Middle duties to remind you that it is Administrative Professionals Day. So if you work with someone that is that quarterback, making sure that the trains run on time in the office or within your operation, don't forget to acknowledge and thank them for everything that they do. Okay, we need a sports dedication that connects snugly with the theme of big truths. How about we dedicate the episode to some hard truths regarding pro sports? Now, there are more than a few, and we tend to ignore them or look the other way when we enjoy and celebrate the games and the players and the teams. So this week, we can serve up a dose of truth to keep it real. The first hard truth is the brutal stats for becoming and staying a pro athlete. It's beyond a long shot. Only 30% of NCAA seniors are still playing the sport they started as freshmen, and of those that are left as seniors, less than 2% get an opportunity to suit up for a pro team. You do the math of high school athletes who make it to NCAA Division I, and then a small cut of that small cut that make it to the pros. That's why I always wince every time I hear a young adult saying their goal is to make it to a pro league in a sport. It's not impossible, but it is highly, highly unlikely. And it gets even more challenging with the truth for those very few who do make a legitimate go at it in pro sports. Very, very few of them in pro, right? And an infinitely smaller smidgen of that very, very few stay pro. Because most often, once an athlete makes it to a major sports league, the clock begins ticking the moment they're drafted or sign with their first team. Across basketball, baseball, and football, the average career lasts just 3 to 5 years. And while the annual salaries can appear substantial in the headlines, it's going to have to last the athlete the next 40 or 50 years of their lives. And there are agent cuts and taxes and so on. Plus, most sports athletes, they don't make the truly big money anyway. Now, many a financial expert speculates that the majority of players who aren't in the make-a-contract stratosphere, they end up with severe financial problems within 5 years of retirement. A typical carpenter or nurse, they don't have that danger. They don't have to deal with those problems. So think about that for a minute. The advantages of a carpenter and nurse over a pro athlete. Another hard truth about pro sports, those multi-billion dollar teams and franchises, they always promise local markets a huge economy boost if the city or state pays up to subsidize or cover construction bills for stadiums. But the truth is the financial bump, it's a fraction of what was promised, and in some instances, it never comes. The arenas are only occupied by home teams a handful of dates out of the year, and it leaves the city to find ways to subsidize the cost for the rest of the time. So stadiums for football, they're probably the worst when it comes to utilization. You got billions in construction costs so that you can use the facility 9 times or so for regular season NFL games and a Taylor Swift concert or two each year. It's a lot of capacity that is hardly ever used. And it's not sound economics or efficient use of tax dollars. And that brings me to the last hard truth of pro sports. While the on-the-field or on-the-court star athlete is making maybe hundreds of millions of dollars, the rest of the support crew is making peanuts. Certainly not a living wage or even close to one. Consider the pay for the parking lot attendants or the food vendors or the ground crew or even the cheerleaders if your team has them. Their minimum wage paying or slightly better. And how many of those workers have 401ks? And how many of those toiling have health insurance? And why are we taxing the working poor and middle class to pay for these stadiums so that billionaire owners can be subsidized to pay salaries to multimillionaire athletes. Remind me of that rationale again, because I'm lost there. Yeah, the hard truths of sports, they tell us that a lot is illogical with pro sports. But the selling of the dream, boy, it continues in our culture and all of it. The stark hard truths of the economics of pro sports, all of it serves as a fitting dedication for episode 153 as we start on our big truth connection journey. Here's a big truth that may be the most surprising, at least it was to me. And I suppose I shouldn't be as shocked by this truth, but it just struck me as weird when I recently stumbled across it once again. The topic is how different asset classes perform over the long haul. Let me be more specific. How do the major investment asset classes perform over time versus the inflation benchmark? That's a crucial question because the objective of investing is to achieve a rate of return that exceeds inflation over your investment horizon. If your return exceeds inflation, you've enjoyed a real rate of return and your portfolio grew in value. But if your returns are at or below inflation over the long term, at best you've treaded water, and at worst you've destroyed or lost value on a relative basis for your portfolio. It's not good. So I'm looking at data that show the frequency of outperformance of certain investment asset classes versus inflation over different periods of time. 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, and 20 years. The asset classes include treasury bills, intermediate and long-term treasuries, real estate with respect to home prices, commodities are in there, gold is in there, as well as, of course, U.S. equities. And those are, I think, the major investment asset classes that most of us consider when setting up and managing our portfolios for the long term. When you filter the data for those categories over those time periods, a couple of big truths stand out and that have held pretty much constant since 1926. So the first big truth is maybe the biggest of all. U.S. equities have outperformed inflation over a 20-year investment horizon 100% of the time since 1926. That's amazing. Meaning if you invest in a low-cost index fund, say like the S&P 500, and you held that investment for 20 years, you'd be 100% certain to have enjoyed a return above inflation over that time period in any 20-year span since 1926. Once again, I find that amazing, even though I shouldn't be surprised because, again, I know I've heard the conventional wisdom and that the data show over the long term, equities are the better way to go. Now, here's another big truth. Not only were equities the best asset class over a 20-year horizon, but there were some not so good choices with respect to asset class over that long time frame versus inflation. Now, which ones didn't do that well? Well, there were a couple of them. Treasury bills beat inflation only 2/3 of the time when looking at 20-year horizons. Gold outperformed inflation just over half the time over 20-year investment horizons, specifically 55% of the time. And the worst asset class of all versus inflation over 20 years? Commodities. Commodities beat inflation only about 1/3 of the time. Yeah, the data since 1926 show that gold, commodities, and even treasury bills, they are far from safe options when looking to garner returns that exceed inflation, even if you're taking the long-term view and being patient enough to wait 20 years for an investment horizon. Another big truth that jumped out from these data, U.S. equities. They were the best performing asset class for any investment time horizon, from 1 year out to 20 years that we've been discussing. Now, granted, the spread on the percent of time each asset class beats inflation, it narrows as the time horizon shortens or shrinks, but U.S. equities always came out on top as the best performing asset class that provides the best chance of delivering returns that beat inflation. And again, I would not have expected that to be the case. So what does this all mean? Well, of course, you know, prior performance is no indication of future performance or success. That's what you always hear on those commercials and reading those disclaimers from investment ads. And as I've discussed many times on this podcast in prior episodes, equities right now, they are extremely expensive and they're sitting at or near all-time highs, which, you know, makes me incredibly nervous as an investor. But when you look at the data, as we have just done, and those data span a period since 1926, and those data show U.S. equities outperform all other asset classes over the same time. And those data show that as you hold U.S. equities longer, You've been almost guaranteed a return that exceeds inflation. Hey, it serves as a pretty compelling case to stay invested and hold course. Now, is this time different? You know, I don't know for sure, and neither do you. But I thought I'd share these big truths from a very compelling data set with you as food for thought the next time you open and review your 401k statement. Now, if the big truth is that equities are the best asset class to be invested in, let's make a connection to a different type of big truth that helps explain why someone like myself is so nervous when it comes to investing into any asset class today, including equities and treasury bills. I'm sure you've heard, and we've discussed it in the past, but the Congressional Budget Office, or the CBO, well, the CBO came out with some pretty depressing projections recently regarding the financial health of our federal government. And by the early 2030s, the CBO is estimating that all, as in 100%, of federal government revenues are going to be consumed by two things: entitlements and interest on the federal debt. Now, you may be listening to that and think, well, that's a projection and it's not necessarily a big truth. Maybe it won't be as bad. And I'd love to agree, but I must disagree, because those projections are nothing more than results driven by overwhelming math. It really doesn't matter what assumptions you apply to inputs like interest rates and GDP growth and economy. The numbers are so large when it comes to entitlement spending and debt load that the CBO's expectations for the 2030s, they're a mathematical certainty and a mathematical big truth. If the CBO is correct, and I believe that they are, what should some of the symptoms be that we would be expecting to manifest? What should we see happening? Well, first, you would expect the capital markets to start to react. And that would mean yields on treasury bills would increase and the cost of capital for the private sector would start to exceed expected or see its risk spread grow versus where the Federal Reserve sets its benchmark interest rates at. You should see downward pressure and volatility with equities. And you should see gold skyrocketing in price. You should also see analysts and rating agencies starting to question and downgrade the viability of U.S. debt. Now, these entities will usually be late to the game and sort of playing catch up, trying to explain why the markets have already reacted negatively to what the rating agencies should have seen coming years prior. But nevertheless, you'd expect these sleepy entities to start waking up to the pending danger. And these symptoms, they're one of the reasons why I am so nervous as a long-term investor today. It feels like we are on the edge of a very rough patch in the capital markets. And when you apply this simple math, as the CBO has done, it overwhelms to only one possible outcome, an outcome that spells danger and trouble and big truth. And what is a way to avoid this big truth and bad outcome? How do you change that overwhelming math? Well, there's only two paths to do so, and we may need both, frankly, to successfully avoid a really bad outcome for all. One way, one path, is to raise government revenue. Simple. Basically balance the budget and satisfy the math by taxing more. Now, there's a whole host of tactics that can be brought to bear to do that very thing. You can cap 401k contributions based on income. You can remove the cap on Social Security taxes for high-income individuals. You can raise the payroll tax rate. You can institute federal tax on municipal bonds, which are currently not taxed. Of course, you can raise both income tax and capital gains tax for the higher net worth or higher earning individuals. And you can further limit itemized deductions such as mortgage expense. I think a big option would be for the government to drastically increase the death tax on estates. You could see that, and that would become the biggest wealth appropriation in the history of mankind when the baby boomer generation dies off and the government realizes it needs to take a bigger estate tax bite to balance its budget and make ends meet. And it's straight up value appropriation, no doubt, because the net worth of that estate, it's already been taxed at least once, if not multiple times, over the life of the deceased. So for the government to take yet another bite, it's double, triple, or quadruple taxation, depending on the circumstances. But it may need to happen with a much bigger bite from government, because again, the situation fiscally might get desperate quick. And then the biggest way the government can raise more revenue, it's a tactic that we've been discussing many, many times on the far middle, and that is instituting a carbon tax, or perhaps what might be advertised as a value-added tax or a VAT under the PR marketing of tackling climate change, something like that, while in reality, it's just a ruse to simply raise more revenue so the government doesn't default. I got to tell you, I don't think any of those tactics of raising revenue seemed all that appetizing to me, constant listener. I certainly don't like any of them. So what about the second path that can help avoid or adjust the overwhelming math that spells trouble ahead? Well, that path looks to reduce government spending, which means to make enough of a material difference, it necessarily means reducing entitlement spending. Things like means testing for cost of living increases for Social Security beneficiaries, excluding individuals with high net worth or high income from receiving any Social Security benefit, drug price controls, limiting scaling back Medicare benefits based once again on either income or net worth. And there are a host of other options under this tactical pathway, all of which in the end are reducing benefit and payout to certain stakeholder demographics. That's not politically popular, and in some instances that might prove to be political kryptonite, which means it's not going to be the preferred path of policymakers anytime soon, or at least until we hit a fiscal wall. What is not a fix, because it simply won't move the math enough, unfortunately, is to cut government discretionary spending. When you assess non-defense discretionary spending versus things like interest on the debt and entitlement spending, you can eliminate all non-defense related discretionary spending and not make a material difference in avoiding a fiscal crisis, and even avoiding or delaying the time until you hit the fiscal crisis. That option's been taken off the table long ago because the debt has ballooned to such a large level, and our deficit spending, which is driven by entitlements and interest service cost on that debt, starting to push out literally everything else. Make no mistake, the first big truth is that if we do nothing, our government is going to default. The second big truth is that to avoid the first big truth, our government will need to either raise massively more revenue via taxes, drastically cut entitlement spending, or probably both. The math is simple and it's overwhelming. Get ready, and this is going to hurt, and I speak big truth. Let's take that connection as to where finances of government may be heading and tie it to another discussion point. President Biden and his job creation performance since in office and his job approval rating. Because of schedule, I taped this episode a few weeks prior to the air date, and it wouldn't surprise me at all if we suddenly woke up one day between the recording and airing date to find out that President Biden is not going to seek re-election. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if that occurs after the air date of this episode. Why? Because his re-election is facing serious headwinds and risk, even against a very vulnerable and often unlikable opponent, President Trump. So allow me to explain with a few big truths. First big truth is that if you were to plot presidential popularity through the presidential approval rating just over 1,000 days after inauguration, for every president since the end of World War II, no one has experienced a more dismal approval rating than President Biden. Presidents Trump, Obama, LBJ, and Carter, it came close, but they still enjoyed higher approval ratings than Biden just over 1,000 days in after inauguration. Now, the second big truth is that when it comes to payroll growth since inauguration and after those 1,000 days plus in office, Biden is tracking quite well versus his post-World War II predecessors. In fact, only two presidents saw a bigger percent increase in payroll growth than Biden. And those two names are going to surprise you. They weren't Reagan or Clinton or JFK. No, instead, those two presidents that have posted the highest payroll growth 1,000 days in after inauguration since World War II have been none other than Lyndon Johnson and Jimmy Carter. Those are the only two who beat President Biden on that metric. So clearly, for some reason, payroll growth doesn't correlate to presidential approval rating, at least 1,000 days after inauguration. And the reason it doesn't in the case of President Biden may be explained by the third big truth in this connection, which is when you break down those non-farm payrolls across the nation and you plot those numbers over the past 6 years, you see that President Biden is enjoying a healthy payroll growth number purely because of the pandemic shutdown rebound. In other words, when President Biden took office, the nation was just restarting its economy after the draconian shutdowns of not just economy, but life and society, you know, to stop the spread. Not. And when you assess where the non-farm payrolls were before shutdown, you see that most, if not all, of President Biden's payroll growth over those first 1,000 days in office simply trended the nation back to where we were or slightly above it before the pandemic shutdowns. So net-net, President Biden hasn't been on an epic job creator path. Maybe the American public realizes that big truth more than we give it credit for, which would explain President Biden's abysmal approval ratings. Love the way this episode played out. Sometimes with these Farmiddle weekly forays, I can't tell until it's done, but I am pleased with how this one played out. I hope you are pleased with those big truths that we discussed. So let's make a final closing connection to big truths, and more specifically, big songs about truth. Now, there are two from the alternative rock genre that immediately come to mind, and I love them both, and I love the two groups that performed them. We'll start with the older of the two songs, and its title is Truth Hits Everyone, performed by the legendary group The Police. It's an underrated single by The Police that often gets overshadowed by their more popular hit songs, especially on radio play, but that track from the 1978 album Outlandos de Amor is Vintage Police. And the English translation of that album title, by the way, is Outlaws of Love. Truth Hits Everyone, it's a little bit punk, a little bit rock, a little bit pop, which is basically what The Police were. And as this episode has shown, the title of the track rings true because, indeed, truth does eventually hit everyone. That album by The Police, very underrated. It includes So Lonely and Next to You, and of course, the staples Roxanne and Can't Stand Losing You. But my favorite song on that album is the oft-unknown Peanuts. So give Peanuts a listen. Heck, give the entire album Outlandos a spin. Great classic work from a great band. Love it. The second of the two songs, this one comes from a group that got their start and achieved their fame a bit after The Police. They started to gain a niche but intense following in the 1980s, but they really exploded in mainstream popularity in the early 1990s. The true song is better known than The Police's Truth Hits Everyone. The song is Policy of Truth by Depeche Mode. Now, the album you find Policy of Truth on is Violator. That album, I think, is a sonic gem, as is the song Policy of Truth. It's one of those works that has a feel from start to finish, the entire album does, to the point where the sound engineer or the producer, whoever that was that led that sort of charge for that sound, they should be an official member of the band. And I've always found that feel for Violator to be a bit threatening or sinister. Do you agree if you know it? And listen to it even if you don't know the band or if you don't care much for alternative synth music, I think you'll really enjoy it. A World in My Eyes, that's a great opener on that album. Personal Jesus, of course, is on there. Enjoy the Silence. That was another monster hit from Violator. That album was a big part of the soundtrack of the early 1990s for those old enough to be driving around back then. Now, the opening lines of Policy of Truth are, "You had something to hide, should have hidden it, shouldn't have you." I disagree because, as Sting told us, the truth will eventually hit everyone. Yeah, The Police and Depeche Mode, they occupy significant space on my CD shelf. Yeah, I still listen to and prefer CDs. I need a physical manifestation of music that I can hold, just like I need a book to hold when reading. Digital music and ebooks, they're okay, but they're not superior to the physical packaging for me. I hope you had fun this episode, and I will look for you tiptoeing through those spring tulips until next week.